What's Next from American Security Project. I'm Maggie Feldman-Pilch. Today I'm joined by Ted Vogel. Ted is one of ASP's adjuncts and is president of 12 South International. Ted, thanks for joining us.
Not a problem. Thank you for the invite.
So first, tell me a little bit about 12 South and what is it that you do?
Long ago and far away, I came up with the tagline, it's all about helping people reach the point of right thinking. So we're a renewable energy consultancy and proponent group, myself and my partner and various subcontractors that we work with. We work specifically in distributed generation spaces, so not at the utility scale, but more at smaller projects, say 10 megawatts or less, that would be behind the meter for businesses. My background in military and DOD side of things is looking at renewable energy and diesel electric energy efficiency. So in other words, move less fuel into combat theaters, which also dovetails really nicely into the Caribbean markets and the remote Canadian markets I'm working in as well, because most of them either are diesel powered or their costs are pegged to the price of imported diesel fuel.
Right. So that's a great opening for a couple things for us to talk about. And the place I'd like to start is you and I have had some conversations about maybe I will call it fuel efficiency in various places that DOD is active. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the overarching problem and the thing that you see most in the news, maybe less now since we're in a very low troop presence sense in Iraq and Afghanistan, is logistics is the tail wagging the dog, and moving fuel is often more important than moving water. Water is, obviously, you need that to live, but fuel you need to maintain.
To go anywhere.
To go anywhere, both for vehicles, aircraft, and stationary power systems.
Right.
So what specifically happened when I got into the DOD space was there was issues around moving fuel through hostile areas in Afghanistan, and I was working for a private security company at the time. So we started to figure out ways to employ solar energy, wind energy, and energy storage at these remote sites to decrease the risk to the convoys coming through the villages. There were also some secondary ideas around employing locals to actually run the systems, the construction work, and when you're talking about 80% unemployment heading up into the foothills of the Tora Bora Mountains, it seemed to make a lot of sense. Out of that, what I realized was is that it's not that there's a data deficiency within the DOD around the way they use diesel fuel and energy, but it's a matter of the Army looks at it one way, the Marine Corps looks at it another way, the Navy with
there's
Secretary Mabus.
There's not a strong narrative there.
Exactly. And more importantly, there's no central overarching system looking at what are we doing, how are we doing it, how can we do it better or use less. Basically, 2011 ended up going back to Afghanistan doing actual data collection on operating generator sets. We found that most of the Department of State sites we were surveying as part of the international narcotics law enforcement effort, their generators were underloaded by 45% to 86%. So they were burning three times more fuel per kilowatt hour than they needed to on average at $17.50 fully burdened cost gallon. And that's the Army's numbers, and 13.2 million barrels burned in theater in 2009, which is the Rocky Mountain Institute's numbers. If you just take 20% inefficiency and apply it to that, that's a $1.9 billion excess expenditure for one fiscal year.
Wow. In one
fiscal
particular
year.
Area as well.
And then some of the numbers around 2008, 2009, with 4,000 casualties or so between Iraq and Afghanistan, some people said as many as 1,600 of those casualties were directly related to fuel.
Wow.
So that's the other side of the coin. I mean, I got involved in this because I have friends who are in the operations community, and some of their kids call me Uncle Ted. So it, you know, there was a passion behind it, but also a practicality as well.
And that practicality, I mean, it's a huge number, but what does that mean? You know, and we're talking about an excess amount of fuel, and you're saying over $1 billion, so that's money we're spending we don't need to be spending. That's what you're saying.
It is, but there's also a nexus between the administrative intent and the operational intent. I think, and I may be very badly paraphrasing, even misquoting this, but one of the quotes I heard attributed to General Schwarzkopf was, give me whatever I need and then give me three more of them, when he's, you know, going into combat. And I certainly can understand that. But at the same time, you have efforts within the Navy and the Marine Corps to look at Camp Leatherneck in Helmand Province in 2008. They had 19 megawatts of gensets running all at the same time, and they had about a 5.5 megawatt load. So they were ready for the fight, but they also were running fat rather than lean.
Right.
And what it came down to was is that it was an issue of data. So you can get data off of everything, down to individual electric outlets if you choose the right plug set. So our solution set that we came up with, and this was myself working with Homer Energy in Colorado, working with Vector CSP in Elizabeth City, North Carolina, and working with a company called GeoIQ, which is now owned by Esri, we created a concept plan to field a data collection capability to the Army. And, you know, realistically, it's a really good idea, but we also ran right into the drawdown on all of this. The nice thing out of that, though, is that data analysis and that data capability has sprung into looking at remote power for underserved communities, like in the First Nations communities in northern Canada, and then basically throughout the Caribbean. They've got a big data and grid stability problem, energy data and grid stability problem. So the model actually moves into the private sector pretty successfully as well.
And that's something we're going to talk about in a minute, but I just want to fixate a little bit on this data. Not something that you hear so much about in security. We're very fixated on hard security, traditional security. And of course, you know, we're learning to use a vocabulary of smart power these days, but we'll see how that goes. Data isn't something you hear so much. And I'm curious your thoughts, really looking at this very interesting leverage point of energy and supply and distribution, how data can impact security and how we plan and how we do.
Well, the thing is the biggest problem we ran into in looking at building the tool and addressing the shortfall is you have a grid-tied mentality. I mean, it's very Western to think I'm going to arrive at point A and then I'm going to walk into my hut and I'm going to plug in my iPad and then I can look at pictures of my niece.
Right.
Or whatever it is you need to do. However, if you take I'll use the example of the camp we looked at in Herat. It was a training facility that was scratch-built and designed to be connected to the then non-existent national electric grid. As far as I know, the camp's only about 2 miles south of the airport, southwest of the airport. As far as I know, the grid isn't there yet. So within that camp, they put in two large generators that were sized to correspond to the size of the transformer that the city power grid would put in place when it had mains power, you know, poles and wires coming down the street. It was running at about 150 kilowatts, but it was rated at 800 kilowatts. So again, gross inefficiency. There were other design problems as well. But they basically looked at it from I'm a Westerner designing a camp to international electric standards, all very good things. But when it came to the power supply, they didn't consider that the diesel gen sets were much too large because there was some metric within the contract that said it had to be able to service a certain amount of amperage or however it works out. In reality, once we did our analysis for the camp, if you had an 800 kilowatt gen set, a 600 kilowatt gen set, and a 400 kilowatt gen set, the 400 kilowatt gen set would have run about 7,900 hours out of the year, and you have load sensing switchgear, which is a customizable commercial off-the-shelf solution that will allow you to switch between the generators. Then from an operational security standpoint, your medium-sized generator gets blown up or breaks down, or all of a sudden you've got 500 extra people in your camp and you need a whole bunch more power all of the time. You can walk over and just flip the switch and run the big generator 24/7. When we actually modeled the fiscal ramifications of making that change, the proposed equipment costs, we didn't do a logistics, we just looked at comparable, you know, what's there, what we can put in place. It was a $470,000 cost using DOD scheduled pieces of equipment. And the fuel savings paid for that $470,000 cost in 4 months and 1 week.
Wow.
And this is all comes down to the fact that you have data logging that comes out of the generators. You've got data that can come out of your air conditioning units and heat pumps. You've got data literally down to the outlet that you plug your iPad into. and you can track all of that, so you can determine usage. And then our effort secondarily to that, or after that, would be to actually look at the system and say, if you put in 500 kilowatts of PV in a battery bank of this size, then your fuel usage will go down this much more.
Interesting. And, you know, I guess a couple of years ago now, ASP had an event, a conference, looking at the relationship between electricity development and security. And one of our speakers kind of eloquently stated, bad things happen in the dark, right? There is a clear tie between a secure power supply, yeah, an efficient power supply, and stability. Which leads me to my next question about the Caribbean, and mm-hmm, most specifically Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. As we all know, Puerto Rico is no longer facing, but is in fact in the midst of, a very serious debt crisis. And as we've discussed at ASP, and as people are starting to realize, energy plays a key role here. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I will not step into this saying that I'm at all an economic, you know, expert on the island,
sure,
of Puerto Rico. I was here for the really well done panel a couple of weeks ago around Puerto Rico, and I found a lot of the things in it enlightening. From a standpoint of my efforts as 12 South and with my primary client, EWT Direct Wind out of Amersfoort and Holland, we've been looking at the market as a way to offer businesses a lower cost purchase option,
right,
for energy. And we've got one project that we're hoping to sign a letter of intent on shortly. But when you look at the overarching concerns of energy on the island, you've got everything from age of infrastructure problems, mm-hmm, you've got points of service delivery issues, you've got brownouts, you've got high costs, you have the tax base leaving the island at an exponential rate. So
right,
there's when you have a usage charge and a kilowatt hour charge, you know, the charge that covers like poles and wires, overhead,
right,
G&A, debt servicing, that pile of money is going to be spread out consistently against a smaller and smaller group of people.
Right.
And the entry-level Puerto Rican is going to be the last person that they probably try and tackle that to. So you're going to,
right,
probably see it more shoveled off onto government accounts, higher level of service accounts, and higher demand charge accounts. So within that, that's one thing. The other side of the equation is Puerto Rico's in this kind of quasi-federal state when it comes to the point of regulation. Capital risk is actually higher, even though,
right,
it's a territory. So the solutions are pretty simple from my point of view. There's a higher level of things that was discussed with, you know, federal intervention and things like that. But when it,
mm-hmm,
comes to a business standpoint and an innovation standpoint, Puerto Rico's distressed infrastructure, in my opinion, can be supplanted by renewables. You can dot them around the islands. It actually will make the grid firmer.
Mm-hmm.
But kilowatts only go as far as they're needed before they're consumed. So you can put it on a hotel. The excess load that's not coming to the hotel will then create stability outside of it. It's kind of like you're doing the reverse of dropping a rock in a pond. You know, you're pulling the rock out and the waves come in. So it,
yeah,
loosely.
Yeah.
I'm not an electrical physicist either, just
That's
for the
right.
record.
You can't be all things to all people.
I can try.
But it's very interesting, and you think about, you know, this debt crisis and the incredible cost to run PREPA, the state-owned.
They're $9 billion in debt.
Which is, I mean, frankly, insane. And there is clearly a role for the private sector here and a role for innovation, and energy seems to be the place to do it. You know,
mm-hmm,
you listen to what you're saying about the efficiency and data work you did in Afghanistan, and certainly one hopes that that is not the level that Puerto Rico is at, but how can you begin to climb out of debt and rebuild a stable economy when your power supplier is $9 billion in debt?
These are all really good points. I think the overarching thing and potentially the simplest thing from a policy and legislative standpoint that would help Puerto Rico would be repealing the specific prohibitions under the Jones Act that increase,
right,
costs for everything,
right,
on the island. If you're bringing in bunker fuel that's coming in on a tanker from France, and it's got to be offloaded to a fuel farm in the U.S. rather than going direct to the island, it's going to end up costing you more money. Taxes are going to go up. Costs are going to go up as the population declines. You've got tourism concerns with the Zika virus being, in my
right.
opinion, largely overblown in the press, and there's a lot smarter stuff out there, but it's not the the don't go to Brazil for the Olympics, you know, hullabaloo that's going on at the moment. But relative to the rest of that, I think that Puerto Rico has the ability, if approached sensibly, to allow businesses to innovate and drive the energy future of the island forward from a reduced capital perspective. So the average cost of energy for the client I'm currently working with down there for 2015 was 13.6 cents. That is readily replaceable with off-island capitalized projects to get them well under that rate. There's also beneficial tax advantages with production tax credits and investment tax credits applying to wind energy and solar systems in the U.S. Where you run into a problem in dealing with this at a utility scale is large projects take a long time to permit.
Particularly in Puerto Rico.
Particularly in Puerto Rico, but just in general. Like the doing a project on federal property takes approximately four times longer than it takes to do on a civilian-owned piece of property that's literally right next to the same site.
It's
because
a whole different
ballgame. Advanced compliance and NEPA and environmental studies. A lot of those rules are in place for extremely good reasons, do not get me wrong, especially with military bases having brownfield concerns and things like
that. Exactly, yes.
But when it comes to Puerto Rico, the nice thing about the island is that they have a sub-megawatt class distinction of being able to do distributed generation projects. So you can put in your 500-kilowatt solar array over the parking area for your hotel, or your hospital, or your rooftop for your business, or whatever it is. And it's relatively straightforward to getting the process done. Where I have fears of projects like this on the island is once PREPA sees a lot of people doing it, or a lot more people doing it, rates are going to go up, compliance issues are going to step in, paperwork is going to get more intensive. But the economics of the island still make it a worthwhile candidate to pay attention to.
So, Ted, I guess before we wrap up, one of my last questions is, you know, looking beyond Puerto Rico, maybe looking at other U.S. territories like Guam and the very interesting fuel system they have set up there, and generally the Caribbean at large, energy could really transform that region in a non-colonial manner. So 10 or 15 years from now, let's say, you know, we use data as we should, what do you think that means for the region?
The Lesser Antilles and the Greater Antilles are two probably areas that you should make distinctions on relative to energy in the Caribbean, because, well, long story short, you can add power in various ways, but when you add power that if the sun goes behind clouds, it drops off, or the wind changes, it increases or it decreases, there's a great deal of design concerns within that. And this is where data becomes very, very, very important. So within that sort of scenario, for instance, well, let's take Anguilla. They have a 6-megawatt total grid size on the island. If you were to put a 2-megawatt wind turbine by itself there, you run into all sorts of supervisory control problems where you're going to be pushing the power speak pipe, spike, trough, spike, trough, based on wind speeds. You can overcome that, but based on data and looking at the scenario, you'd be better off putting in 3 500-kilowatt machines because, long story short, they just provide smoother power. When you look at data as a whole, stretching it out to this 10 to 15-year perspective, where I run into a problem as a small business, and where I run into a problem in a consultancy sense, is a lot of this stuff that is going on in U.S. territories is very top-loaded with investigation. It's very top-loaded with, you know, we need to understand grid stability. When in reality, you can go into these areas and put in, you know, 20% renewable energy systems, like island-wide on Guam or on the U.S. Virgin Islands, and there's really no secondary considerations or controls. What that does, though, from a business standpoint or from a government standpoint, is it decreases costs. It allows taxes to be spent in other places. Or, more importantly, in the case of Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands, it increases the profitability of the local business, which then actually increases the tax base. It also then increases the employment capability on the islands as well.
Well, it's very interesting, and as you noted, you know, ASP has been doing a lot in this space, not just energy, but looking at Puerto Rico. specifically. So hopefully we'll have you back and we'll see what that means down the road.
I'm always happy to be here.
Wonderful. Thanks for joining us. This has been What's Next from ASP.